1 John chapter 2. I'm just going to read a couple of verses as we come to the night that some of you have been waiting for and some of you have been dreading. That is, when we actually begin to talk about how you would acquire a spouse. And some of you are like, no, we are not ready for spousal acquisition. It's just not time. For others of you are like, bring on the spouse. We're ready to go. But, well, wherever you are in that spectrum, again, just remember that 97 to 99% of you will one day enter into a marriage relationship. And so you need to know how to do that. And the verses I have for you tonight are not specifically related to acquiring a spouse, because really, there are no Bible verses on acquiring a spouse beyond something like Proverbs 31, which says, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. Well, I mean, that means you got to find, right? There's a process of seeking. But generally, there is no biblically directed means of getting a spouse. There are simply biblically directed heart desires that then get fleshed out in relationship. That's the issue. So really, 1 John deals with that. And 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 12, John addresses the various groups of maturity in the church that he's writing to, the churches he's writing to, and then gives them an exhortation concerning the nature of love as it relates to the things of the world. So that we're just going to do this, and then we're going to kind of dive into spousal acquisition part one, but I will be referencing this concept of what true love really is, what it isn't, and then really the various levels of service or levels of pursuit of Christ that exist. So 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 12, I'm writing to you little children. That's one group in that church or those churches, those who've most likely just come to know Christ, those who are new in their faith. I'm writing you little children because your sins have been forgiven you for his name's sake. I mean, that's the one thing that young believers are more excited about or should be than anything else, that my sins have been forgiven. I am now able to enter into a right relationship with God, and my conscience is no longer screaming against me day and night to tell me that I'm condemned, even if I'm denying that. So I'm writing to you little children, your sins have been forgiven you. I'm writing to you fathers. He jumps to kind of the most mature group in the church, because you know him who has been from the beginning. It's interesting, Selena was reading about the nature of relationship that has to do with knowing, and not simply knowing information, but knowing experientially, having lived with someone and having knowing about them as you have related to them. So he talks to the more mature people in his congregation. He says, look, you know the Father. You have a relationship that's deep and strong is the implication, because there's this intimacy that exists. Okay, I'm writing to you because you know him who has been from the beginning. I'm writing to you young men, and now kind of the middle range, those who have, they're not new believers, they've not, you know, they're not matured into, let's say, an older age in their Christian life, not necessarily old in their age, but it says, because you have overcome the evil one. And guys, when it comes to relationships, you're going to have to get to level two, which is overcome the evil one. Yes, first and foremost, if my sins are forgiven, this is awesome, but you're going to have to progress, and you're going to have to progress into overcoming what Satan would do to try and derail you. He can't steal your salvation. He can't take it, but he can derail you into all kinds of difficulty, and one of the primary ways he does that, really the primary way he does that, is through your relationships. We're talking about friendship relationships, how those can go wrong. If you don't respond properly to your parents, how that can go wrong. And now we're going to talk about how you would enter into a relationship with that might lead to marriage with a member of the opposite gender, and how badly that can go wrong. We're also going to talk about how great it can be, but you're going to have to overcome the evil one. And young men, as it were, and most of you, many of you fit in that category. That is, you've been believers for a while. Okay, some of you are brand new believers. Some of you are not believers. Some of you have been believers for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, and really, although you're young, you ought to be in that young man category, which is you have the ability, by the Lord's grace, to overcome the evil one. He goes on to then reiterate, he works his way back through that list. I've written to you children because you know the Father. Now he says, look, here's another aspect of, again, just being brand new, is that you too have a relationship with God himself. I've written to you fathers because you know him who's been from the beginning. He says the same thing to them. Your strength is in the core of that deep, strong relationship you have with the God of the universe. And then, I've written to you young men, and really, it's not just men, that is, it's speaking to those who are men and women who are in this kind of learning range, this strength range where you're entering into your strength as a believer. I've written to you young men because you are strong in Christ, not strong muscles. And the world just exalts that kind of thing. You got big muscles. You got to be a Marvel superhero, and you know, with all the roided out muscles. No, you need to be strong spiritually. I've written to you, young men, because you are strong. The word of God abides in you. That's how you are strong. The fact that you have listened to the word of God, that it's changed you, that it has caused you, your character to be molded and shaped, and you have overcome the evil one. That's how you overcome him. When you're strong in the Lord, in the strength of his might, when the word of God abides in you and that word flows out through you in overcoming sin. And then verse 15, he moves right into this. Do not love the world. Here's what it is to succumb to the evil one. That is, the Satan himself would tempt you with what? The love of the world. He doesn't come to you and whisper in your ear and all that weird stuff you see on TV and read in weird books where he's like, you know, he's going to whisper things. No, he comes through the culture. He comes through your own sinful mind, will, and affections, the sin that remains as believers that causes you to love things that you shouldn't love. So he makes the culture look really good, like with Eve, when the tree looked really great and her thought of being like God seemed really appealing. Well, that's what happens. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. If you're characterized by a love for worldly things, that is what the world desires, the same motivations the world has, then you're not a Christian. And yet believers, he's talking to believers, he says, look, you're not to go back to that kind of behavior, because someone who just loves the world isn't even a believer. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father. This Father that these children and young men and fathers know and love, the love of the world is not from him. It can't be. Those are incompatible. The love of God causes you to shift from a love of worldly things, worldly motivations, doing things the way the world does them, and causes you to love God in such a way that you want to do the things that he desires. Because that's what the love of God is. It is a delight in him, which causes you to long to bring him glory by obeying him, by sharing his character, by pursuing the things he loves and the things he wants. And he says, the world is passing away. Why? Why? Because the world's passing away. I mean, all the things in the world are going to be gone. The loves of the world will be condemned unto eternal hell, and only those who know and love and serve God will last. The world is passing away, and also its lusts, its desires. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. It's a pretty good reason to love God, because that characterizes the Christian who then lives forever. His relationships his relationship with the Lord is firm and eternal. And even your relationships with other Christians are then in that sense eternal. You will know and love them and be with them for all of eternity. So that kind of grounds our understanding of relationship, love of the world versus love of God, properly loving one another. I guess that's what drives us. Not some book on dating and some, you know, thing on courtship, and you know, all those things are fine. We'll reference a lot of those. But the bottom line is a love of God versus a love of the world, and your growth in maturity, so that what you are driven by in your relationships is first and foremost a love of God, which means then you can properly love someone else and you can properly enter into a relationship that would lead to marriage with not a worldly love, but a godly love. There's only two great commandments, right? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's going to drive all of your relationships. That's going to drive your dating, if you even want to call it that, whatever we'll call it. If that doesn't drive it, it's wrong. It's going to lead you to destruction. So that kind of sets the stage for our discussion of spousal acquisition part one. How do you get a wife? Now, we're going to take this in stages. And I'm going to kind of jump to what it would be to enter into a relationship that you would use or that you would begin to pursue marriage with. But what we'll understand is that most of you are not even in that category yet. Okay, so I'm going to first kind of lay out what it would mean, what a relationship looks like in which you would be seeking to acquire a spouse. And then as we work our way through this, we're going to talk about the kinds of relationships that might lead you to that kind of relationship. Because just jumping from 7th grade into spousal acquisition is like, whoa, no. Right? Even jumping from 11th or 12th grade, you're like, I'm not necessarily acquiring a spouse. But what you need to understand, and hear me really carefully, is that once you move past about 7th or 8th grade, when you begin establishing relationships with members of the opposite gender, male with female, female with male, you need to keep the idea of spousal acquisition in mind. You need to be thinking through what it will one day mean to be married and why you are pursuing the relationships the way that you are. That's really important. That should be on your mind from the very beginning. Because once you move past 6th grade, we're just kind of hanging out and, dude, I like you, and gender is really, I mean, it's there, but it's like nobody's paying much attention. 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th grade, gender means a lot. And it's starting to really become obvious. And the way you relate to each other is very much changed. And I'm saying people don't play with it lower than 6th grade. They do. Starting about 4th grade, just things go weird. Right? But there's not really any strong understanding of what's going on. About the time you hit 9th, 10th grade, you're starting to see things you never saw before, be aware of things you were never aware of before, and that's when you need to have marriage in mind. Not that you're going to marry that next person, but that the goal of a male-female relationship at the end of the day, for the vast majority of you, is going to be marriage. And just playing at male-female relationships leads to tremendous pain and difficulty. This, people's hearts, hear me carefully, people's hearts are not to be played with. Individuals are not your playthings. And we will see that very clearly. And by the time you start reaching 9th, 10th, 11th grade, and you start having relationships with male to female, then and female to male, you start playing with hearts. You start dealing deeply with hearts. And you need to do that more carefully. Every one of you, every one of us needs to do that much more carefully. People are valuable in the eyes of a holy God. And how you treat them matters. That's fundamental. You don't play with them. And so we're going to have to be really careful here, because you can try to deny it. I'm just friends. We're just buds. I'm not thinking anything about, you know, that the fact that they're a girl. You're wrong, and I know you're wrong. You are not telling me the truth. If you're hanging out 9th, 10th, 11th grade, you think, I don't even think about the fact that she's a girl. Yes, you do. Young men or young women, same thing. I don't even know he's a guy. Yes, you do. All right? So we've worked our way all the way from the basics. What is a man? What is a woman? What does the Bible say? And now we're coming to here. All those other things matter. If you missed that stuff, you need to pick it up. What does the Bible say a man is? What does the Bible say a woman is? What does the Bible say the roles are? None of that was just, I wasn't just flapping my gums for no reason. All of it applies to now as you begin to think about, how am I going to get married? And if you're not thinking about it, you ought to, again, because you don't want to end up married by accident. So, I just got in a relationship, seemed like we should get married, we did that, and I don't even know why I'm here. All right? I don't know what purpose I have. Some of the parents here, you did that. And you end up in a relationship, you're like, woo, how'd I get here? Right? Well, that's not the ideal way. God was gracious to you, right? He loved you, and he cared for you, and he helped you in your relationship. But you don't want your kids entering in that way. So parents, thanks for taking my challenge. Thanks for coming. Because we want to be saying the same kinds of things. And I don't want your kids to go home and say, what do you talk about? You know, what do you say about spousal acquisition? You guys are going to be, I don't know. I don't have any idea. And your parents are going to be, no, he said something. So now they know. And you can sit down. And I want lots of conversations. Not all of these things are biblical commands, as we will find. So it's not everything is like, you have to do it this way. In fact, a lot of this, not so much tonight, but as we move our way through, is not going to be some kind of biblical command. If you don't do it this way, you're not spiritual. But you better start talking about it. And you better have a plan. In my own dating experience, in my own relationship with members of the opposite sex, I was told two things, and not by my parents, but by my youth pastor. Two things. Don't date an unbeliever, and don't have sex before marriage. That's it. That's all I was told. And by the Lord's grace, I did those things. But I needed to know a little bit more. I dated one person when I was in high school, when I was a senior. You think, you're a loser. I wasn't really interested. And actually, she asked me. I've told a little bit of that story. She asked me out. I said, okay. But I was not thinking. I had no idea. I remember we walked around the school for hours. I was grilling her to see if she was a believer. But I was going to go out with her anyway. See, and so I just was kind of answering my own questions. I'm not sure she actually was a believer. She's kind of a cultural Christian. Not, I mean, it's not her fault. But I kind of wanted to, I was already a little bit too late at that point. I didn't develop the relationship along those lines. Anyway, it's not all about my experience. But nonetheless, I felt later on, I realized I was totally unprepared. My parents never had a discussion with me about how I would do this. Never. Right? And really, my youth pastor didn't either. Lovely, wonderful man, my mentor. He's grown in this area, but he didn't have much to say about it. I think the other thing he said, which is right, was be godly. That's probably enough. Be godly, don't date an unbeliever, and don't have sex before marriage. That'll get you a long way. But there's more to be done. This takes a plan. It takes thought. So, the relationship story is pretty much the same, isn't it? It still happens the same way it's always happened in a worldly sense. What does the world say? You got a boy, he meets a pretty girl. Or a pretty girl, she meets a strange, mysterious boy. All right, that's kind of how that works, right? He might be a little angsty, and you know, he's sarcastic, and he was a little mysterious. So that's usually how it works. The boy meets a really pretty girl, and the really pretty girl meets some kind of strange, mysterious boy. There's some barrier that keeps them from getting together, right? It's parents or some mean authority figure, or you know, they're lost in a maze somewhere if you're in a science fiction thing. I don't know, right? But finally, they break through the barrier. They have their romantic time together. They're kissing each other by the end of the time, and then they enter into some kind of undefined relationship that sometimes ends in you know, physical intimacy, sometimes ends later on in the movie in marriage. But there's no idea of what happened. What's that relationship look like? What is that? And that's pretty much all you see. Oh, okay, so once I overcome the barriers, we start kissing each other, and then we enter into some kind of undefined relationship, and we might end up in marriage, or we might end up somewhere else. That's about the best the world can do. Well, I think we biblically need to do a little better than that. So we're going to try. So help me out. When you think about the word dating, what are some things that come to mind? We'll talk about, again, worldly, how the world dates, how young men and young women enter into relationships that ostensibly could be marriage. But how does the world deal with dating? Give me some characteristics of worldly dating. How does the world do this? What does it look like? Yes. Yeah, right. You have some kind of candlelight, and you know, I did that one time when I was in 12th grade, and we're having this kind of candlelight dinner. So it was four of us, actually it was six of us, three guys, three girls. We weren't really all that interested in each other. And I remember passing the bread, and it had a napkin in it, and it burned up. Anyway, so that was my best example of, you know, that will ruin the ambiance. All right, we're right. Some kind of romantic thing, right? So dating often is viewed as that. Let's get in some kind of romantic situation. Yes. Yeah, you're going to go see movies. Oh, that's always the first date, right? Go see a movie. Or you see a lot of dating on movies. What else? What is worldly dating all about? What's it like? Yeah. Gifts, right? Give cool things. Which, again, nothing wrong with that. That's kind of fun. Other things that worldly dating, the world views as, okay, if you're dating, you're this. Now, help me out with that. So if you're dating, what are some characteristics of that? Giving your scrunchie to someone. Giving your scrunchie. Whoa. Okay, that's deep. All right. Here's my beloved scrunchie. You're mine forever. Okay. Selena. Phone number, oftentimes it's it, you know, give me your phone number. And these days you don't call what? You text 800 times, you know, send 50 pictures, sometimes good, sometimes not. The snap, okay, which one, so what is that? Thank you. See, I'm not even in, so right, so you Snapchat them. Yes. Yeah, that's right, so if you are dating, then it's like Life 360. Where are you? And if you text them and they don't text you back in 5 seconds, you get the question mark. Where are you? I'm in class. What are you talking about? All right. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Having a good time. All right. That is oftentimes viewed as, hey, you're just having a good time together. That's okay. Anything else that's expected in a dating relationship? What's that? You got to look good. Of course. Generally. Right, so whenever you're around, you go, and that's, you know, that's why you make sure when you're going out somewhere and you're going to see them that you look maybe different than you look when you're slobbing around the house, which is probably wise. But, all right, anything else that is required in a dating relationship? All right, well, we'll work our way through. You guys hit most of the ones that I have. There are some other ones that I think are implied. I would say that the thing that I experienced that is watching dating relationships, remember, I worked at McDonald's for about 6 years. Back then, young people instead of old people worked at McDonald's. They didn't expect that it was going to be a living wage. We paid them minimum wage, which was like $3.75 an hour. It was a transitionary job where you did that for high school. So lots of high schoolers and college students. And the relationships that I saw, there was one primary characteristic, which was fighting all the time. No, just ever. I walk around the corner. Rah, 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 rah. I told you about the one. I walk around the corner. The girl takes a fry basket out of 460 degree grease and brands her boyfriend with it. All right. Yeah, that's bad news. All right. But it was just fighting 24/7. Oh, fighting and gossip. All right. Those two things in my book characterize relationships: fighting and gossip. Well, we'll see if we can do better than that. But I would say our current dating system is irretrievably broken. It is simply not possible to date as the common manner of the world would say, and remain holy. The way they approach relationships is fundamentally unholy, generally, because it's not focused on true biblical love, it's focused on self-love. Now, that bears itself out in the percentage of couples, those in high school, who end up in premarital physical intimacy. It's somewhere between 30 and 40% of them. And the percentage for Christian couples is essentially exactly the same as for unbelievers. Why? Because they approach their relationships the same way. And you enter into the same with the same thought, into the same kind of system, and you end up with the same result. But even if you don't end up in bed together, if you don't end up in physical intimacy, and I'll do my best to be delicate here, but because there's realities that are all over this that most of you guys are already aware of. But even if you don't go that far, usually there's tremendous damage done along the way. There's this false intimacy that's developed. There's this developing this fake shell of who you actually are to constantly pretend with people so that you can get what you want. It's just nasty. Nasty to the very core. Why? Because there's not true love. It's all stated love. It's all stated, you know, I love you and you love me, and people saying that thing like, you know, saying that 5 minutes after they meet each other. Please. So we're going to work our way through trying to change that system. It's bad. It's broken. But you got to have relationships. I'm not here to say, well, just don't have a relationship. How's that going to work? You're going to have one. You love them. You were built for them. So I'm not here to talk you out of relationships. I'm here to talk you into biblical ones. And I'm here to try to show you, help you biblically to move in a pattern that will enable you to carefully care for one another in relationships. So please hear me. I love relationships. I entered into a marriage relationship that is now 31 years in the making, and it's sweet. And our time, by the Lord's grace, of entering into it was sweet. Those things are awesome. But you better treat them carefully because they can go really badly wrong. So essentially, the proposition for the rest of this time is that God desires every believer who marries to enter into that relationship with a Christ-exalting foundation of purity and maturity. And thus, he provides all the principles and power necessary to achieve this end. God desires every believer who marries, and that's most every believer, to enter into that relationship with a Christ-exalting foundation of purity and maturity. And thus, he provides all the principles and power necessary to achieve this end. It can be done. And we'll talk about the fact if you've already been impure in a relationship, then that's the beauty of knowing Jesus. Because he forgives you. And you can restart and renew and rework a relationship in such a way that it's pleasing to the Lord. Maybe not the present relationship you're in, but the other ones. It's because there's endless chances in Christ. And that's the beauty of knowing him. It's not one shot and you're done. You mess up one time, sorry, your marriage is now going to be ruined. Because you want to minimize mistakes in this area. You do, because they're hard to overcome. But in Christ, they can all be overcome. I just want you to start overcoming them now and not enter into them now so that you don't have to overcome bigger, harder things later. That's my goal, and we'll see how we work our way through this. In essence, dating relationships aren't in the Bible, but relationships are the focus of the Bible. Dating relationships are not in the Bible, but relationships are the focus of the Bible. So I think we're going to be able to figure this out. I think we'll be able to work our way through it. And my prayer is that each one of you, every one of you, would have joyful, godly relationships and ultimately ending in marriage for most of you, that you will look back and say, that was sweet. That was awesome. Yeah, we had wrestles. Yeah, we had some struggles. Yeah, I broke up a couple of times. And yeah, my heart was hurting over that. I mean, we're going to talk about this fallacy that you can somehow have a relationship with someone and guard your heart. That is, it will never get hurt. Please. Try to love somebody in any form or fashion, and they don't desire to pursue a further relationship with you, you're going to hurt. That's just how it is. But we want to minimize the nature of that hurt, and we want you to be able to overcome it in ways that please the Lord so that you don't have a rupture in between those two people. So we're not only talking about how to enter into relationships that might lead to marriage, we're also going to talk about how to exit out of relationships before they lead to marriage. Because you're going to need to learn how to do that too. And if there's anything I see that's probably worse, a lot of times people enter in fine. They enter out really bad. They hate each other afterwards, and the whole youth group gossips about the whole thing, and the whole college group gossips for the next 6 years about how that worked, and it's sickening. So let's try to not do that as best we can so that we can honor the Lord. Relationships are all over the Bible. They're the focus of it. And so we want to do them well. All right. Now, on to your outline, biblical narrative methods for spousal acquisition. Here's the danger of narrative, because most of the marriages you see in the Bible are built on narratives. That is, we see certain historical things happening. Be careful of building theology off narrative. So if you want to learn how to get married, let's consider some of these narratives. How about how Jacob got married? So this is how he did it. Let's do this one. Work 7 years for a woman whom you dearly love and who also happens to be your cousin, but that's a story for another time. go through with the wedding, and the next morning find out you've married the woman's sister. Repeat for another 7 years to finally obtain the woman you wanted in the first place. Don't think we're going to put that one in a book, all right? Spousal acquisition, Jacob style. Nope. How about David style? Kill 100 Philistines, circumcise them, present the circumcision to the happy prospective father-in-law who was just trying to kill you anyway. No, I don't think we want the David method. That's not going to go well. How about the Abigail method? Take 200 loaves of bread, 2 jugs of wine, 5 prepared sheep, 5 measures of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, load them on a donkey, sneak out without telling your husband, find the man that you will one day marry, fall on your knees before him, beg him not to act sinfully, make excuses for your foolish husband's behavior, go back home, wait for God to kill your husband, then respond to the man's summons for marriage. No, don't think we're going to do that one either. Abigail didn't know all that. I get that. But that's how the narrative worked, right? How about the Benjamite method? This is my favorite. The whole tribe of Benjamin did this evil, evil thing in the book of Judges. And so the rest of the tribes of Benjamin said, we're not giving you, or the rest of the tribes of Israel said, we're not giving you our wives. We're not giving you our women to be wives. Forget it. You're so evil that we're not going to give you, we're not going to intermarry with you. One of the tribes of Israel. But they came up with this great plan. They said, look, there's not going to be enough women for you, so hide in the bushes. Wait for the pagan, drunken, virgin, Saban women to come dancing by. Scoop them up, carry them off to your house, and marry them. All of this with the approval of the governing authorities of Israel. No, let's not do the 7 brides for 7 brothers approach. All right, that's not going to go well. Don't try it. How about the Hosea approach? Hear a word from God to take a prostitute as your wife. Marry her, watch as she returns to a life of prostitution and slavery, then purchase her back from her owner again to be your wife. I don't think we're going to go with that one. I wouldn't, if you came to me and said, this is my plan, I would say that's a bad plan. God sovereignly worked in that, I get that, but you that's not how you would do that. How about the Joseph? That is Joseph in the New Testament. How about his plan, which was essentially have your parents sign you into a marriage contract with a woman who's a distant relative of yours, suspect her of committing adultery, out of love, desire to divorce her secretly, yet when confronted by an angelic being, decide to go forward with the marriage ceremony anyway. No, none of you would lay that down. Say, let me write that one out. So you see the problems with trying to look at the Bible and say, that's how you get married. The Bible doesn't really tell you how you get married. It happens all kinds of weird ways. And by the way, that ought to give us a lot of hope. Not that I want you to do any of those things or enter into marriage sinfully or foolishly, but it gives a lot of hope for those of us who did or those who did. Because the Lord is gracious and good in the midst of those things. But the bottom line is to try to do this well. All right, if you read all the books out there, I've read them. Like all, most of it. I haven't read every book out there, but I've read a bunch of the Christian books. There's essentially 5 types of cultural spousal acquisition relationships, Christian cultural. Here's how it's normally done. There's one type that's just called the countercultural way, which is whatever the world's doing, try to do it opposite. I mean, that's probably a good principle, but it's like, how does that actually work? You still got to get a wife, right, or a husband. So that's a little hard. It doesn't have any specifics. It's just find a mate unlike the way the world does it. Go do that. That's not real helpful. Then there's the courtship model. That is the head of the household, usually the father, holds the authority over the couple's relationships. Both parties commit to pursuing marriage, although breakup is acceptable under some circumstances. Now that works pretty well, can work, if both dads are strong believers with similar ideas about relationships. It doesn't work so well if one set of parents are unbelievers, if your child is an unbeliever, if your child is acting like an unbeliever, or if you're a little bit older in life. Right? This seems to make relationships more serious than they should be from the beginning, and really doesn't give any way to get to the courtship stage. All of a sudden, you're talking to the dad, say, I think I want to marry your daughter. Well, how do you get there? I mean, you're doing that at 14, 15, at 16, no? It microwaves relationships really fast, and then makes them really hard to get out of. Hey, I talked to your dad, and he said, you're mine. I've heard that, by the way. Can't get out of this thing. We said we were going to do that, and he said you're going to do that, and so he said you could be mine, and there can be problems. Courtship's not all bad, but it's not all good either. Then there's what's called the principled approach to relationships, which there are 10 biblical principles. Things like, you know, have commitment in your relationship, be God, some great things there. That's a good thing, but it doesn't really tell you what marriage is for or how you work your way that way in a structured fashion. There's the betrothal method. I'm sure you all want that one. That's the view there, and this is modern betrothal, not old-fashioned betrothal, but that is any sort of dating to fraud someone. So if you ever ask someone out and you're not planning to marry them, you're sinning against them. That's this view. It's not my view, by the way. It's the betrothal view. Anytime you ask someone out, if you don't end up marrying them, you've sinned against them. That's how that works. If you break a betrothal, that's sin in this view. The only scripturally normative path is betrothal, in which a couple enters a permanent commitment to marry one another at the start of their relationship. Just think about how badly that can go wrong. All right. And I've actually sat with someone who said, look, we were betrothed. And the woman said, look, I want to break this off. And I was trying to work with this guy to help him realize that when she said that she would go out with him and that even pursue a little bit further down towards marriage, that when she said no, that she wasn't in sin and he was having nothing of it. And it took me months to work my way through that. Actually, you're in sin, buddy. But anyway, that was a tough one. And then there's just kind of a purposeful. This one is, look, dating, if you got some biblical guidelines for relationships, can be fun and godly. You just get to know members of the opposite sex this way. Just ask someone out and then go out for a couple weeks and then ask someone else out and go out for a couple weeks. And this is a great way to get to know people. I'm not a real big fan of that. Not sure that's a real great way. I think friendships are good. We'll talk about that. But entering into, hey, let's date for a while, and well, we got no commitment here, and just want to get to know you in this kind of intimate, I don't think it works too well. So anyway, those are kind of ways to do it, and really all of those, except maybe the betrothal method, have, because that is biblical precedent, but not really biblical principle, because all of those probably have some aspect of truth to them. They have principles that are important, and we're going to try to just, again, combine biblical principles together to set a pattern for relationships. And then at the very end, we'll talk about some maybe things that would be wise as far as specifics go. All right, so that was the countercultural, courtship, principled, betrothal, purposeful methods. Those are all kind of ways to do it. Now, I'd like to define at the outset here then what I would consider a spousal acquisition relationship. Well, what am I talking about? All right, and again, I'm going to try to make clear where the biblical principle, where there's biblical command, and where there's maybe wisdom, and maybe where there's just some experience. And we'll try to work our way through those. They're not all the same thing. All right? But in Proverbs, consider these verses. Proverbs 12:4, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. She who shames him is like rottenness to his bones. Probably be good to find a good wife if the one who shames you is like rottenness to your bones. Proverbs 18:22, he who finds a good wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. So you need to find a good one, as opposed to a bad one. It would work exactly the same for a wife having a husband who's bad. Proverbs 19:14, house and wealth and inheritance are from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. That's a precious gift. And then Proverbs 31:10, an excellent wife who can find are worth as far above jewels. So this needs to be done right. This needs to be done well. It does matter who you marry. It does matter the person that you're thinking about. It's not just anybody, anytime, anywhere. It takes some thought and some work from our side as best we can. So if I was going to define a general definition of a spousal acquisition relationship, I think I have it down there for you. And again, the Bible does not give this definition. We're just trying to put our mind around what does it mean to move from unmarried and single to married. Some kind of relationship has to get us there. So if I'm going to define it, I would say generally it's this: developing a Christ-centered relationship with a member of the opposite gender for the purpose of pursuing marriage and with appropriate accountability to family and or the church. Developing a Christ-centered relationship with a member of the opposite gender for the purpose of pursuing marriage and with appropriate accountability to family and church. And again, I know some of you are a ways away from that kind of relationship. I get that. But you're going to need to be thinking about it. That's why I want you on this. You're one day going to do this. You're going to develop a relationship with a member of the opposite gender for the purpose of marriage, and you need to have right accountability with your parents and or the church. So that's, I think, generally a good general definition of what this means. Now, what are the conditions for this? Well, what's going to make you ready to do this kind of thing? Again, here we just have biblical principles. There's no command as it has to work exactly this way, and you have to have all these, but there's some principles here that if you're going to enter, if you have a relationship in which the goal is marriage, there are some things that you need to be thinking about. So all these things won't be true necessarily at the start of the relationship, but they are the direction you're working. For example, most importantly, a true growing relationship with Christ. Please hear me. I've said it before. I will say it again. You should not, you must not enter into a relationship which could end in marriage with someone if you're not a Christian. And if you are not growing in Christ or desiring Christ, then you shouldn't be shackling someone with you. We'll talk more about that. We're so selfish. You're not walking with God. You don't really like God. You're in rebellion against your parents, and you're going to go find some young woman or some young man that you're going to enter into a relationship with. You're dooming that person to a bad relationship because you're bad. You get that? So easy we put that on the other person. Don't find someone who's not walking with God. You walk with God, and don't burden you, someone else with you, if you're not. I love you. I care for you. You ought to know better than that. You need to walk with the Lord. And you got no business playing in relationship if you are not walking with God, and you know that God exists, and you know his standard for relationship, and you're going to draw some young man or young woman into a sphere with you, and you don't love Jesus much, either as an unbeliever or as someone who just at this point you might be a believer, and you're like, but I'm walking with God is the last thing on my mind. Maybe that you're not one. But 2 Corinthians 6:14 is clear. Don't be bound together with unbelievers. That's talking about only about marriage. That's talking about any pursuit with unbelievers that matches you together with the same motivations, same desires, same purpose. You can never do that with an unbeliever. It's impossible because you don't have the same motivation and you don't have the same purpose and you don't have the same desires or the same approach to anything. If you don't know that by now, then you're totally missing what it is to be a believer. You're totally different. What you want is different. The way you pursue things is different. I mean, you wear clothes, you have relationships, you have desires, but all of that for the Christian is different. The motivation is entirely different than the world's. And if it isn't, then you got no business going together with someone like that. What partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship has light with darkness? The principle holds. If you're not a believer, don't enter into a relationship with someone and don't enter into a relationship with someone who isn't. And if you're not walking with God, start walking with God. First, you need to be the kind of person that you would have someone enter into a relationship with. And you need to find someone who's walking with God. Does that give you good impetus to walk with God? Sure does. You want to enter into a marriage relationship someday? Sure. Walk with God. Love Jesus. Pursue him. But don't harm someone else's life by drawing them into a relationship with you when you're not loving the Lord. It's the kind of thing where, you come home and, hey, Dad, can I go out with so-and-so? Was he a Christian? I think. You think? Why are we having this discussion? You should be able to know, tell me, here's what's up. You wouldn't have the discussion that way anyway. But, I think he's a Christian. I think she's a Christian. You got to know for sure. You don't know how. You don't know why. You don't know where. There ought to be evidence. It's the beauty of a youth group, by the way. You get a chance to see people. And when they claim to be Christians, you get a chance to see if they actually are. Now, I understand it's got to be past Wednesday night or Sunday morning because people are a lot different when they walk out this door. They're different by the time they get across the road. They're different by the time they sit in the back of the bus. It's amazing. I love you guys. I think most of you want to serve the Lord, but I know some of you don't. Well, I'm not speaking of individuals, but I think that's probably true, and I think you know that's the case. So, you guys, not just what they look like, but you do have a chance to do things with people and get engaged, see people, and see if they're really believers, a true growing relationship with Christ. Secondly, a demonstrated commitment to the church. Everything. What does it have to do with a spousal acquisition relationship? Everything. What does the Bible say in Matthew 6:33? But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness and all these things, which would include spousal acquisition relationships. Everything from food, drink, relationships, everything. And all these things will be added to you. What's his kingdom? What's seen visibly in his local church? If you don't have a commitment to that, if those things aren't coming first for you, you got no business entering into a relationship because you got your priorities backwards. It's not about the relationship and then you'll find a church or you'll be in a church. The issue is you are loving the church and that's how you build your relationship. Hear me, it doesn't mean you have to marry someone in the church you're in. It's not a bad thing. I mean, but again, you are committed to the church regardless and they're committed to the church regardless. And then the hard part is you got to figure out if you're in different churches, where are we going to go? That usually is a further issue. But nonetheless, you both love the church. A general idea of what God would have you accomplish in life. That is, young men, how are you going to lead, this would be for the man, how are you going to lead a woman, say, hey, we're going to enter, we're thinking about, I'd like to enter into a relationship with you that will end in marriage, and she's like, well, what are you leading me towards? I don't know. What are you going to do with your life? I don't know, hang out and play video games. That's probably not it. You need a plan. You don't have to have your whole life planned out, but you need to have thought enough that it's not like, I've never thought about that before, so come follow me. Young ladies, just say, when you get a plan, when you got something, then let's talk. You don't have to have your whole life mapped out, but I'm going to go here. This is what I think the Lord has for me. I'm working these things. I'm doing this. Again, as I told you, this is down the road for some of you. And as we'll see, this doesn't fit well necessarily within even the high school realm. Again, we're going to talk about how you get there in high school. But most of this is kind of projecting you a little bit outside of that because you don't know some of that stuff. You're like, what are you talking about? I'm just trying to get through my junior year. I'm not leading anybody anywhere. I don't know what's going on. So you probably shouldn't be entering something that would lead to marriage. All right, you need the general approval of parents and or church, general approval. This doesn't necessarily mean they love everything about the person, but they are approving. Hear me so carefully here. Any and every kind of relationship you have is under the direction of your parents as long as you are under their roof and receiving their provision. Can I say that again? Any and every kind of relationship you have is under the direction of your parents as long as you're under their roof and receiving their provision. Stop with the Disney fantasy, which I can have any relationship I want at any time I want, and I deserve to have that relationship, and my parents have nothing to do with it. That's utterly and absolutely unbiblical. Your parents have the right to tell you no or yes or this is how much and this is how little with every relationship you have. Now, you can negotiate. You can try. Do what you can. If you want, I would like to have more. I would like to have, fine. At the end of the day, when they say it's this way and this way and this way, you say yes. You want the right to do that on your own? Move out. Now, again, you can't move out when you're 16, 17. Law won't let you do it when you're 16. Maybe 17 and a half, you could get away with it. I don't recommend that. I'm going to move out to get a relationship. It's the most foolish thing I ever heard, so I'm not advocating that. I'm just simply saying, as long as you're sucking the air in their house that they're paying the air conditioner money for, that cool air that blows on you in the evening, they're paying for, the food you eat, well, I buy my own food, yeah, because they enable you to go to work and don't take all that money from you. We could go on and on. They're paying the bills, you are under their authority, and their right over your relationship is total. Total. Now, you can walk. Now, many wise parents they'll work, they'll give you some leeway, but they're not required to do any of that. And if they see a relationship isn't going right, wham, they have every right to shut it down, and they should. Talk about it. Sometimes you can, there's ways to do that better. But guys, show me in the Bible one place where it says you have the right to run your own relationships underneath your parents. That is, you can do it. Show me one place. I'll yield. People have been trying to do it I've been in ministry for 32 years. Not one passage has ever been shown me. Because the biblical command is complete. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. Who are children? Anyone who is still underneath the authority of their parents, because the parents are paying the bills, or legally they're required to do that. So guys, I don't mean that to be mean. I think most of you agree with me. You're like, great, that's wonderful. But some of you are wrestling with that. You're not going to get any advocation from me to say, well, you can do what your parents don't want, and it's okay if you really don't like your parents very much because of what they're doing with their relationship. Don't sit with me and ask me about that, because I'm going to tell you, do what your parents say and honor them and love them and respond to them. I might say, look, talk to them. Maybe they don't understand. I get it. Maybe you need to communicate better. I might do all that for you. But I will never tell you that it is okay to ignore your parents or to be mad at them or to not obey what they say. Ever. Ephesians 6:1. You also need to have the legal, intellectual, and practical ability, now, by the time you're moving towards marriage, to move out from underneath your parents' authority and support. That is, as you are reaching this spousal acquisition point, you are reaching the point where you can be on your own. Because for you to say, hey, I want to carry out my relationships and do all my stuff, and mom and dad, will you pay the bills? No. Right? And they're going to require that of you, of course. Like I said, that's why not a whole lot of high school relationships fit this bill. This spousal acquisition bill, because it's like you might be working that way, but you're going to take some time. Galatians 2:24 says, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Doesn't mean you have to move. I mean, they could provide for you a place to stay. I get that. But the bottom line is you have to be able to make provision generally, and you're forming your own separate family. Thinking, whoa, that's a little ways down the road. Mm-hmm. So that's why you need to be careful about how you're pursuing these things now. Means of supporting your spouse without your parents' help. At least you're working that way. So by the time you're getting closer to marriage, you're saying, all right, I've got that plan. And if you're entering into a relationship, say, hey, babe, or hey, dude, I'd like to eventually marry you. Well, what job are you going to do? I don't know. How are you going to support us? How are we going to? I don't know. I guess it doesn't have to be much. My wife and I moved out, and we got married in the middle of college. I'm not saying that's the best way. I'm just simply saying it was like we're going to die if we tried to make it 2 more years into college for a lot of different reasons. So I was 2 years in, we're like, woo. And we put it together. We cobbled it together. We lived in our little 700-square-foot apartment, and we ate, I ate McDonald's. That were all my meals. We ate ramen and other stuff. Elisa was diabetic. We had to work a little harder on her side of things. We made it work, but I didn't call my mom or my dad and say, hey, could you pay for my meals, right? So you see it. But you guys, that we had that plan. The plan was, if we're going to do this, I got married at 20, right before I turned 21, so we're not done with school and some of those other things. But you got to have a means. All right, so that means for most of you, you're thinking, okay, Chris, you're talking about stuff that's projecting me a little bit into the future. Yes, I am. When you get serious, if it's the kind of relationship that's leading to marriage, these things need to be on your mind, which means they need to be on your mind now as you consider how the path to even get to that kind of relationship. How am I even going to get to a spousal acquisition relationship? Now, before I even, and that's really going to be next week and maybe the week after as well, what are you doing in high school? How are you preparing for that kind of relationship? Well, let me say this. The great difficulty of locking in a relationship when you're in high school. We're going to be high school sweethearts. You've heard the stories. And some of them are real and true, and they're sweet. They saw each other when they were in ninth grade. We're going to get married. And they did. Most of those are absolute disaster, quite honestly. Some of them work out fine. But here's the problem with locking in a relationship early. You're locking in a relationship with someone who hasn't spiritually or emotionally formed yet. They're 16 years old. They might look nothing emotionally or spiritually like that in 2 years. Then you might grow along with them and find that that's great. Usually they change in a lot of ways, and you're like, I don't know that that's great. The person you are looking at 16 or 15 is not the same person that they're going to be, even with normal growth and normal maturity, that they're going to be 2 years later. And it's amazing in those years, 16 to 18, 16 to 19, a lot of those characteristics are forming. In fact, their love for the Lord is generally forming about right there. And they seemed real rah-rah for the Lord, and everything was cool and great, and they're hitting about 18, 19, and you're kind of locked into a relationship, and all of a sudden, they're not even sure they're a Christian. And they seemed really strongly to be a Christian beforehand. You did all your homework, and you did all that stuff, but it wasn't the real deal, because they weren't formed yet. So be really careful. I'm not saying it doesn't work. It can work. I'm only saying you just got to be really careful with that. I call it the HSGS syndrome. Sounds like a disease. Well, I call it the high school graduate syndrome. High school sweethearts, convinced they will marry, graduate from high school, and something turns off. It's almost always in the girl's brain. Almost always. And I watch it happen. They're hanging out in high school, having a great time, and then they graduate, or one of them graduates, and all of a sudden I look at the way the girl is responding to the guy, and I'm like, it's over. And he doesn't even know it. And I know it before he knows. Guys, I'm not going to give you names, but I can just tell you. And he doesn't know. And I'm like, oh, man, I wish he'd tell him quick because it's not going to be pretty. Guys, it's not her fault. Nothing wrong with it. She's not to be faulted for that. All of a sudden, she's like, I'm a little more mature. I got a little more going on. I'm looking at you and going, uh-uh. Like, how can you do that to me? You were committed to me. No, you weren't. It's a great danger of this. You said we were going to marry at 16. Are you kidding me? I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm saying you're not to commit to it happening. Because they might change totally. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes they graduate and they're like, you're great. I'm great. We're all great. Let's do it. That's really rare, by the way. It does happen. It's pretty rare. So, again, that's why I want to help you. And we're going to talk about what I would call focused friendships. I'll give you a preview. I have names for things. Don't pin me to the names. It's not my fault. I just got to come up with names for something. All right, so how you learn how to decide when you're 16, 17, how might you be in a relationship that might help you prepare for that? That can be done. You just have to be really careful that you understand what you're doing, which is why you're sitting here on Wednesday nights and why your parents are sitting with you so you don't misunderstand what you're doing at 16 or 17 if you're pursuing something like that. And then oftentimes you're just going to choose to wait. You're going to just be with each other, develop friendships, enjoy each other, and then when you have a little bit more ability to pursue those things, you're going to press on in that direction. Both of those are okay. That's up to how the parents want to run things and how the house wants to go. I'm not telling you one is better than the other, but in both those, you're going to have to be really careful. And wow, I didn't get very far, did I? Not surprising. I'm not going to go further because this next one is really talking about what worldly dating is, and it will give us a contrast to what you're supposed to be doing. So I'm going to end here, but as I do, stay with me here just for another minute. I know we got Birthday Wednesday on the mind. As you are wrapping your mind around this, my young people, younger ones, 7th, 8th grade, 9th grade, those who are like, whoa, you know, talking about leading in marriage or leading towards marriage, here's what I want you to do. I want you to be carefully considering, hear me, how do you view male-female relationships right now? My 7th graders, 8th graders, 9th graders, are they playthings? Are they, you don't think about boys or girls at all? How are the people around you? Because you need to start to be aware of the things. Not because I want to microwave you into having relationships. You have thoughts about relationship. Guys, listen to me. Hang on. You have thoughts about relationship, and the people around you have thoughts about relationship, and you need to be aware of what they are. You need to be aware of the kind of culture you're drinking from as to how you're thinking about relationships. That's where you need to be. My 10th, 11th, 12th graders, you need to be thinking very seriously about, okay, what is my plan here? What are the kinds of things I ask of my parents? What do I think about when I should have a relationship? How do I, when do I want to have one, but what do I think is wise about that? And why do I think it's wise? And how do I want to pursue that in a way that pleases the Lord? You're 10th, 11th, and 12th graders. You're growing up. You can't just do this because you have some, you know, wild hair in your head. I've got to have a relationship. No, think it out. Biblically work it through. I'm not saying you shouldn't have one. I'm saying you need to have a plan. I'm saying you should sit down with your parents and say, Mom, Dad, let's talk about the plan. What's your plan? What do you think? Here's what I think. There's room for discussion. There ought to be wise parents. You'll have some discussion with your kids. You can have do the iron fist, boom, my way or the highway. You can do that, but I don't recommend that. Hear what your kids are thinking. Your kids are all different. All of their personalities are different. The things that they want are different. The kinds of, you know, some are like, I could care less about a relationship till I'm out of high school. Great. Good. Some are like, I really would like to try that. Let's talk about it. Let's work it out. Guys, this is going to take a lot of good biblical back and forth, but as parents and as young people, I want you to start that. And you're starting it this week, and you're working it out. Don't cut your parents out of this. If you've got unbelieving parents, then you're going to have to find some mentors and helpers who can work this through with you. Because I want you thinking, you need to think. Because we're going to be on this for 4 or 5 weeks. And I want you to be carefully working your way through it. There are a few more important things you will ever talk about. Because you need to know how to progress in a relationship. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for our time. Thank you for these young people. Lord, I'm just so grateful for their desire to hear your word, for their desire to pursue relationships in a way that pleases you. And Lord, I pray, Father, I pray tonight that perhaps there would be some or many who begin thinking about this in a more biblical way, whose hearts are moved and stirred to walk with you so that they could actually have these kinds of relationships in ways that aren't hurtful. Father, there would be those here who perhaps would change course in relationships they have. And there would be those who are careful in thinking through and walk wisely in the relationships they do have. Lord, I pray that in all these ways you would be honored. Pray for the parents. Give them wisdom. Give them grace to know how to talk with and work with and strengthen their children in this regard and to hear them and love them. Father, might this be a joyful, encouraging, if even painful at times, moment of time in our youth group, when we work through these things in a manner that pleases you. In your precious name, Lord Jesus. Amen.